For many, I think people would like to believe that they would love to live in a judgment-free world. And when you saw this particular title, if you saw it on Facebook, then you probably, the very first scripture you probably thought of was the one that Bradley just read for us. And that will be the first scripture that we will look at, because I think it is a good place for us to start. When it comes to the matter of making judgments and receiving judgments, I think we need to understand we're not going to escape that. That doesn't mean that all judgments that are made are right, correct. It doesn't mean that we should be receiving judgments at certain times in life, but that happens. In fact, most of our problems, I would think, if you would think about them for just a moment, most of our problems is a result in some way or another of judgments, incorrect judgments, judgments being made from the wrong perspective or wrong motive. You can't judge a book by its cover, we are told. And yet racism is that very thing. I judge you and your worth on the basis of your skin. Bullying is a problem in our society and in our schools. And yet bullying is also a problem of judgment. I make a judgment about your worth based upon your maybe ethnicity. Racism then comes in. I make a judgment based upon your worth by where you live, what kind of clothes you wear, what brand name of clothes you have, or how you look. Just your, maybe you have the right race, but you just aren't one of the beautiful people. And so therefore, I'm going to bully you. Or maybe you're smaller and I'm bigger and I can get away with that. I make a judgment about that. When it comes to the matter of election, I believe we've got that coming up in a couple of days. People make judgments. And they make those judgments and they put those signs in their yards about, I've made a judgment about who I'm going to vote for. And then other people come by and say, well, I think that's a terrible judgment. And so they yank those signs out of the yard. I read the other day where someone had lined their sign with razor blades so that when their sign was removed, they would be heard. And when one of the yard workers came to remove it, sure enough, 9 stitches in his hand for removing it. You see, judgments and making judgments, we're not going to get away from that. We're not going to get away from, as the definition says, the formation of an opinion after consideration or deliberation. We're not going to get away from that. There is no such a thing as a world without judgment. But judgment is a nasty word in the minds of some. But my thought is, well, if judgment is the way that this world is, and we can't get away from it, then obviously that is the way that God has created this earth. He could have made it in such a way that we would never be able to make a judgment. He could have made our minds in such a way. He could have made our bodies in such a way. He could have made us exactly the same, and that there would never be any judgment upon anything that would ever be made. But as soon as we factor in free moral agency, then that tells me every single person has the ability to form an opinion. That's how God designed us. God designed us in such a way that I can make judgments. Well, if God's designed us that way, and God's made us that way, and that's the way this world is, then there must be some revelation about what does God intend for us to do with that. And how should we go about doing that? And how should I do that in such a way that would be acceptable to God? And so I want to think for a little bit this morning about this matter of making and receiving judgments. You've already formed an opinion as to if you're going to like this lesson or not, probably. You've already probably made a judgment about that. That's just how quick, how fast that we make judgments all the time. And so let's start with that very thing. Not this lesson, but let's start with ourselves. I think that's the first place that we ought to start. Whenever we begin to state that I'm going to make a judgment, the very first thing I should be judging before I go out of my head and through my eyeballs look at other people or their signs or their skin or whatever, the very first thing I need to do is I better look at the fella that I see in the mirror. Matthew chapter 7, that's the very thing that Jesus is saying to those that he has been preaching this sermon to. And he is talking to those that he knows are going to hear him. I think that would be the Pharisees, who they have been making judgments about how their fellow man should live. And yet we find that later that they haven't been living by their own judgments. They haven't been living by their own the standard that they've been giving their fellow men to live by. When Jesus gives them a list of woes in Matthew chapter 23. But at the beginning of his ministry, he doesn't lower the boom on them yet. He gives them an opportunity to think about their judgments in the hopes that as they look at others and make judgments about what they're requiring others to do and how they're requiring others to live and the way in which they're taking the law of Moses and making individuals abide by that, how that they're laying heavy burdens upon them, they're for a pretense making prayers as they devour widows' houses. Jesus knows all that's going on, but he doesn't condemn them for that yet. The first thing that he tells them is, I want you to examine yourself and understand that the way in which you judge others will be how you are judged. Would that cause them to reconsider the way in which they're taking the law of Moses and forcing it upon others to live it? Jesus gives them the opportunity to examine themselves. Now we get to Matthew chapter 23, and we find out that they have not done a very good job of it, have they? It doesn't appear as though they've examined themselves at all. Many Pharisees actually became children of God, became Christians. You see, that's the problem. They did not want to examine themselves. But for us, as we think about this passage, what standards do I use in judging others? The attitude that I take, the harshness that I take, the unyielding nature that I have, and sometimes in my judgment, just overly harsh and overly critical. Okay, Jesus is saying, that's going to be the way that you judge others. That's how God will judge you. Paul talks about this from another standpoint in Romans chapter 2, and it shows that sometimes the complete inability to even see ourselves. In Romans chapter 2, Paul says, therefore, you have no excuse, every one of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself. Now, how is it that I could judge you, but I'm the one getting condemned? I'm not even the one being judged. You are. He says, for you who judge, practice the same things. I've made a judgment about your practice, and your practice is incorrect. But Paul says when you do that, you condemn yourself, because in that which you are judging another, you're doing the same practice. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. But do you suppose, O man, when you pass judgment on those who practice such things and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? Let me tell you, have you ever had one of those aha moments when you recognize that what you have been critical in another, you just did the same thing? I can tell you I have. But wow, I can't believe that I did the very thing that I have gotten on to. When our kids were little, I would catch myself doing that, and there were times that I had to go and apologize to them and say, I'm getting on to you for doing that, and I just did it. That's not right. It's amazing how quickly that we can, and easily that we can look at others and not see ourselves, and see in others what is wrong, all the while doing the exact same thing. There may be some other aha moments that I should have had that I didn't have. And of course, for that, I always pray that the Lord will enlighten me into things and areas in my life that I didn't see and that I didn't catch. And so show that to me so that I'm not being inconsistent in the way that I'm living, that I'm saying one thing and doing something else? Have you looked at yourself before looking at others? In 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5, the Apostle Paul says that what we are interested in this matter of judgment, and this is all that God is interested in, is, are you in the faith? Paul has had to deal with objections to himself, accusations, insinuations about the reason that he was preaching and the reason that he was going around, even then, collecting funds. He's not collecting funds for Paul's personal retirement account. It was collecting funds to be taken to deliver to Jerusalem so that the poor saints there could be helped. But he was still yet accused for preaching for money. He's not really an apostle. You know, he didn't walk with the Lord like Matthew. He didn't walk with the Lord like Peter, James, John. He's kind of a second-rate apostle. And so Paul is having to deal with this, and so Paul has had to embarrassingly, through the book of 2 Corinthians, put forth his credentials for being an apostle. And so he has weathered their judgment of him. And now he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5, okay, I have given you and I've weathered your judgment. I think it's time, since you've been looking so much at me, I think it's now time that you look at yourselves. Test yourselves to see if you are in the faith. We are good and adept at pointing out the inadequacies and deficiencies of others and how that they're weak there and they're not very strong there and they ought to do a better job there and they ought to do... But do we ever think about the fact that, do I have the same weaknesses? Am I manifesting the same thing? Where are my weaknesses? Am I as strong in the faith as I think I am? We've just partaken of the Lord's Supper. Therein again, God says, look at yourself. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, if you find yourself looking around and seeing what others are doing, or if you find yourself sitting in the back, and that's the difficulty sometimes of sitting in the back, and maybe you look up and you see someone doing this or that, say, well, I can't believe they're doing that. I can't believe you're doing that either. Why is it that we never catch that inconsistency? I can't believe they're not thinking about the Lord. Well, what are you thinking about, the person in front of you that's not thinking about the Lord? And it's just that easy that we find ourselves making judgments, not realizing that we're doing the very thing that we're condemning someone else for not doing or for doing. And so the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 28 that we are to examine ourselves. What manner of partaking am I partaking of the Lord's Supper in? Or else I will be guilty of His blood. Let a man examine himself, and in so doing, he is to eat the bread and drink the cup. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 4, Paul acknowledges the fact that if we're going to boast, we ought to boast not in someone else's failures. It's amazing how that people believe that because someone else fell, that makes them strong. That says something about them. Because someone else has a weakness, that therefore makes me strong. That it doesn't work that way. Paul says, but each one, as talked about, brethren, if anyone is caught in the trespass, ye who are spiritual, restore such one in the spirit of gentleness. So we're in a context of someone has fallen, someone has stumbled, someone has sinned. And so those of you who are spiritual, restore such a one. Verse 2, bear his burdens. He's struggling. He was obviously struggling. That's what caused him to fall. That's what caused him to be overtaken. And so he's struggling. Bear his burdens and you'll fulfill the law. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Why would that be in this context? If someone thinks he is something, upon what basis does he think he's something? I'm not the one being restored. I'm not the one needing help. I didn't do that. I didn't sin. I didn't fall. And so Paul says, verse 4, but each one must examine his own work. That may be. It may be that you're not the one that fell. You're not the one that has been overtaken in sin. You're not the one that needs to be restored. You're not the one that the spiritual are coming to. That all may be. But just because that may be, that doesn't mean that therefore, verse 3, I must be something because I didn't do what this fella did. I must be something because I didn't do what this woman did. Paul said, no. Let me give you the contrast of that. You are not finding your worth on the basis of the mistakes of others. You don't find your success on the basis of others' failures. Let me tell you where you boast. You don't boast in the fact that they fail. You boast in the fact of what you're doing. What are you working? What are your works? What are you accomplishing? Well, I didn't sin. That's great. You didn't sin. What are you doing for righteousness? How are you living godly? What aspects of that are seen in your life? Let each man examine his own work. Then he will have reason for boasting. Notice in reference to what? In regard to himself alone and not in regard to other or to another. If I'm going to boast, I'm not going to boast about the fact that I didn't fall and you fell. Therefore, I must be okay. If I'm going to boast, I'm going to boast in the fact, and this Paul is not talking about being arrogant, but if I'm going to boast, I'm going to look at what I've been doing, what I've been accomplishing, how I've been living, what good I've been doing, and I'm going to focus on that, and I'm going to be pleased that I've been able to serve the Lord, not that you've been able to fail the Lord. That's what Paul is saying. And so in this matter of judging ourselves, are you boasting in your work or in others' failures? We find that we are also individuals that are to judge ourselves in reference to our consciences. Now, our conscience is not supposed to be our guide. It is our moral compass. But, you know, even moral compasses need to be calibrated. Even regular compasses need to be calibrated. I remember the first level that I got, it was amazing to me when someone said, now you'll need to level that. Why do I need to level my level? That's why I'm buying a level for. He said, no, you'll need to calibrate that. Make sure that's right. What? I got to calibrate? That's why I bought this. This is what the conscience is, if you will. The conscience is that which will be and can be our guide, but that has to be calibrated. That thing has got to be calibrated to the Word of God. So you say, well, I'm just going to let my conscience be my guide. Well, who calibrated your conscience? If God hasn't, you don't want that conscience being your guide. Paul said in Acts chapter 23, I did all things in all good conscience. I've lived in all good conscience. I've always done what was right. Wait a minute, you've been on both sides of the spectrum here, Paul. You were a persecutor of the church, and now you're a preacher for Christ. How is it that you can say, having been on both sides of the spectrum, that you've lived in all good conscience? Well, that's easy. When I was over here, this is what I thought I should do. My conscience said, go destroy these people of the way. My conscience said, go destroy these Christians. Stamp them out. But then I was enlightened, and now my conscience says, go make Christians. And so even though I've been on opposite sides of the spectrum, Paul got his conscience calibrated, if you will, according to God's calibration. And when that happened, then he began to preach. But he could say in every area of his life, he had always done what he thought he should do. That's an impressive statement, isn't it? To say that I've lived in all good conscience until now. What I have done has always been what I thought was the right thing to do. Can you say that? Even that's an amazing standard to try to live up to. John said in 1 John chapter 3, verses 19 through 21, we will know by this that we are of the truth and will assure our heart before Him, and whatever our heart condemns us, for God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, We have confidence before God. In Romans chapter 14, the Apostle Paul says, "The faith that you have as your own conviction before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because his eating is not from faith, and whatever is not from faith is sin." It is not good, he said, in reference to the eating of meat that had been sacrificed to idols, that it is good not to eat meat or drink wine or to do anything by which your brother stumbles, he says in verse 21. But then notice verse 22, "The faith which you have as your own conviction. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves." How would you condemn yourself if you approved of what you're doing? You could condemn yourself by causing a weaker brother to stumble. "Well, I approve of eating meat sacrificed to idols, and I'm going to live that way regardless of what this brother says, and so I believe that it's all right, and I'm going to live that way regardless of the weaker conscience of this other brother." And Paul says, when you live that way, even though you approve of what you're doing is right, if you put a stumbling block before him, then you have actually condemned yourself. But, verse 23, which I think is words given to the weaker brother, "But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because his eating is not from faith. Whatever is not from faith is sin." The weaker brother who believes that it's wrong to eat meat sacrificed to idols, even though Paul has said it is not wrong to eat meat sacrificed to idols, but if you believe that it's wrong to eat meat sacrificed to idols and you eat meat sacrificed to idols, then you have sinned. Not that it was sin to begin with, but your conscience said don't do it. You did it anyway. You violated your conscience. You did not do it in faith that it could be done and be approved. And so as a result of that, for you it wasn't approved. It was a sin. I have to make judgments in regards to my conscience. Do I have a clear conscience in the way that I am living? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're right or wrong, but that's a good place to start. Do I have a clear conscience? Yes. Okay. Is your conscience being calibrated by the Word of God? That may then make your examination a little bit different when you come again and look at this question. There's a second thing that I want us to look at, and that is that when it comes to the matter of judgment, sometimes we receive the judgments of others. You know, Jesus was judged by religious people. At least on one account, I want you to go to Luke chapter 7. In Luke chapter 7 and verse 31... Jesus says, "To what shall I compare the men of this generation? And what are they like?" We'll be in this passage in a moment, or the first part of this passage, but I want to set the context by reading all this. "They are like children who sat in the marketplace and called to one another, and they say, 'We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. And we sang a dirge, and you did not weep. For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine. And you say he has a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by all her children.' Now one of the Pharisees was requesting him to dine with him, and he entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume. And standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and kept wiping them with the hair of her head and kissing his feet and anointing them with the perfume. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself," get ready for the judgment, "if this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. I wish we had the time. Maybe someday we'll just explore this. There is a phenomenon that's occurring here in reference to how I make judgments. I make judgments upon my own personal standard. I make judgments in regards to, well, if I was in that person's shoes, if I was there, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have allowed that. That wouldn't have been what I would do. And so because that wouldn't have been what I would do, because of this idea that I have about sin, I mean, there are several things that's wrong with the way that Simon is rendering this judgment. The way that he looks at his fellow sinners, the way that he looks at those who aren't righteous. He was very self-righteous, and he was proud of his self-righteousness. He looked down upon those who did not have it. So there was a problem. You bring that into an occasion where you're going to make a judgment, you're going to make a bad judgment every time. And then with bringing that in, he puts himself in the shoes of Jesus and said, well, if that woman was doing that to me, I wouldn't let her touch me. And so here's Jesus who has let her come in, who has let himself be touched. I know he can't be a prophet because he wouldn't do what I would do, and he's allowing this to happen, so he can't be a prophet. But the problem is that the standard by which, the perspective by which Simon was judging was completely incorrect. But because his standard was completely incorrect in the perspective that he had, it brought him to a complete wrong judgment in that. Jesus was a prophet. In fact, Jesus knew exactly the kind of woman that was touching him. And that's exactly why Jesus allowed the woman to touch him, to destroy the perception, or at least challenge the perception of the Pharisee. But this man sat and looked at Jesus and said, you're not a prophet because you wouldn't have allowed this woman to touch you. You know, Paul was judged by the worldly philosophers when he came into the city of Athens. He really wasn't going to do any preaching until his traveling companions caught up to him. And yet, when he gets there, he sees all of the idolatry and he sees that they've got an idol to every god, and then they've got one idol to the unknown god, those that we don't know about. We'll put them in that category over there because we don't want to offend any of the deities. And so here's to the unknown god. And so he begins to interact with them in the marketplace. And so these men of Athens, they were philosophers. And they loved to hear something new. And boy, was Paul preaching something new. They said that this idle babbler, what would he wish to say to us? Others say, well, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he's preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And so they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is which you are proclaiming. For you are bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean. And then we get this editorial comment from Luke. All the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling and hearing something new. You know, and in one way, though they would probably take exception with this, in one way it was kind of like a gathering of fishermen describing their best catch. Because everyone's trying to outdo the other. Oh, you think that's new? Well, let me tell you, I really heard something new. Oh, you think that's new? Well, let me tell you what you think that's new? That's what Luke says. They visited there. They spent hours spending their time telling and hearing. We just want to hear. If it's new, we're interested in it. Were they? Well, when we look into verse 32, we find that not all of them were very interested in it. In fact, the majority were not. They loved to hear something new, but once they heard it, they sneered at it. Verse 32 says, this resurrection of the dead. But there were some that said, we'll hear you again. Paul was judged by worldly philosophers. You know, in the first century, Christianity received a negative judgment. In Acts chapter 28, when Paul has appealed to Caesar and he finally gets to to Rome, and he gets to Italy. And so it says in Acts chapter 28, starting in verse 17, it says, after 3 days, Paul called together those who were the leading men of the Jews, and when they came together, he began saying to them, brethren, though I have done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. And when they had examined me, they were willing to release me because there was no ground for putting me to death. But when the Jews objected, I was forced to appeal to Caesar. Not that I had any accusation against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I requested to see you and to speak with you. For I am wearing this chain for the sake of the hope of Israel. Thought about this statement when Brother Russell was talking about how the Lord took any kind of thought or any kind of word and turned it into a spiritual application. Here's Paul in chains, said, I can use this. I'm going to turn this into a spiritual conversation. That's what he did. You see these chains? These aren't the chains of a man that's a criminal. These are the chains of one who is preaching hope. That's why I've got these chains on. They said to him, we have neither received letters from Judea concerning you. You see, Paul was afraid that the waters had been tainted before he got there by the Jews. They had done this before in getting word to Caesar in order to rule in their favor. Why wouldn't they do this in reference to Paul? And so they said, we have neither received letters from Judea concerning you, nor have any of the brethren come here and reported or spoken anything bad about you. We've not heard a thing about you. There's been no reports coming here. But here's what we have heard. But we desire to hear from you what your views are for concerning this sect that you say you represent. It is known to us that it is spoken against everywhere. This would be very early in the reign of Nero. This was probably around 60, 61, maybe 62 AD. Nero became Pharaoh, became Caesar in 58 AD. And he was that 56 AD, rather. And at some point, Nero's reign becomes the first great persecution against Christianity. Now, had this been starting already? Possibly. If it was going to start, it would have started right there in Italy. It would have started in Rome. Christians had already been expelled by Claudius, was the adopted heir of Claudius. And so Claudius had expelled all of the Jews and expelled all of the Christians as well. And so it's possible that there is persecution, some. Whatever it was, it would seem as though that at least at this point, this being spoken against everywhere was that all Jews they talked to, I think at this point, is not so much a Roman persecution. I think it's right now, it's just that every Jew that these men talked to, they had nothing good to say about Christianity. And Jews would have traveled, and they would have gone to pilgrimage feasts, and there would have been Jews that would have been going to Rome. And so these Jews said, we have heard, now think about the fact, we've heard about this sect. So they knew about it. Paul hadn't been to Rome yet, and yet word of this sect had already come to Rome. But the word was, we hear nothing good about it. It's spoken negatively. Same thing is happening today, isn't it? When you bring up Christianity in our nation, more and more and more, it's receiving a negative judgment. And if Christianity is going to receive a negative judgment, guess what happens to Christians? They get a negative judgment. Look in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verses 11 and 12. The Apostle Peter says, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so in the thing in which they slander you. You're being slandered as what? As an evildoer. For doing what? What did Peter say? For doing good. Were these Christians worthy to be slandered? Were they hypocritical Christians? Were they Christians who were saying one thing and doing something else? Or were these genuine, godly people attempting to serve God in goodness, doing good? They were doing good, but what were they accused of? Being an evil doer. Doesn't that look like what's happening a lot in our nation today? As we preach the gospel and as we talk to people about doing good and living holy, righteous lives, what are we accused of? Hate speech, hate crimes, fear-mongering. We're accused of being evildoers. Well, guess what, brethren? We're not the first ones to ever have to suffer that kind of judgment. Peter says, as you're doing good, you keep doing good, and you keep keeping your behavior excellent among the very people that are accusing you of being evildoers because of the good that you're doing. You keep doing that. Christians received a negative judgment, even though what they were doing was good. It reminds me of what God said through Isaiah. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. But there are going to be others that are judged by Christians, and we'll get through this rather quickly. There are some people that we had to make judgments on. You know, Jesus made a judgment on others. It's uncomfortable, I recognize. It's one thing to bear the heat of the judgment of someone else. And as you're striving, as we've just looked at, as you're striving to do good and you're striving to live righteously, and yet here we are, we're striving to do good, and what we're preaching and what we're proclaiming is for that person's good. When we talk about the fact that fornication or immorality or homosexuality or sensualism or any kind of sin that might be in reference to covetousness, to money, any kind of sin that people acknowledge as, well, that's acceptable, we bear the judgment. Well, you're just being divisive. Well, you're just hate-mongering. And yet we know, no, we're trying to warn you that, look, yes, I know that this may be legal, and yes, I know that you might be able to do this, and yes, I know that you might be able to abort the child that you have that you don't want, but I'm telling you, you're going to pay consequences for that, as we look at our last slide, at the final judgment. I'm trying to do you good and not wanting you to hear the judgment, the condemnation of God. I'm trying to help you prevent that from happening, but that's not how it's perceived. But we have to give our judgments. We still have to do that. We still have to do that good. That's part of the good that Peter may be talking about. In Luke chapter 7, we've already read part of that text. In Luke chapter 7 and verse 24, when the messengers of John had left, he began to speak to the crowds about John. He said, what did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? Those who are splendidly clothed and live in luxury are found in royal places. If you went out the wilderness, that's not why you went out there. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I say to you, and one who is more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, behold, I send you my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. I say to you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John, yet he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. When all the people and the tax collectors heard this, they acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees And the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves, not having been baptized by John. And so here's Jesus' judgment. To what shall I compare the men of this generation? What are they like? They're like children who sat in the marketplace and called to one another, and they say, "We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, and you did not weep. For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine," and you say, "Well, he's got a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking," and you say, "Well, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by all of her children." What do you want? We don't want John. He's a wild man. He's got a demon. Okay, Jesus came doing the opposite. Oh, he don't want that. He's a gluttonous man. It's just like children who can't be satisfied. I don't want this. I don't want that. I don't want this. I don't want that. Jesus said, that's what this generation looks like. Christians must judge the deeds of darkness. The world may tell us that we are hate-mongering. The world may tell us that we are being unloving. But that is part of the good that's described by Peter, and that's part of the good that we have to do for others. It is out of love that we warn people and tell people, don't you realize that the life that you're living is a life that will cause you to be condemned in hell? Of course, they don't believe in hell. They don't believe in the afterlife, many of them. That's how we have to try to convince them at some point. Your choices have consequences, and those are eternal. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 6. "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience." Now think about that. Let no one deceive you with empty words. What would be an empty word in this context? Don't worry about that. Don't worry about living that way. It's all going to be okay. Don't worry about that. God's wrath is not going to come upon you. Don't worry about that. God understands. God realizes. God will accept. God will be tolerant. Those are empty words. And that's what we're hearing all throughout our nation. Empty words. Because they're not true. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. Are you spouting empty words too? Are you just not saying anything about that? Are you allowing the empty words to go and not be challenged? Or are you spouting the empty words? Therefore, do not be partakers with them. Paul said, better not be. For you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit consists of all goodness and righteousness and truth. Trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. It's good that you figured out that you got out of that. That's not right. That's not good. That's not acceptable. God's not going to be pleased with that. How about exposing that and enlightening others to that? Don't join the chorus of empty words. But all things will be made visible to the light, Paul says. Christians must judge others' responses to truth. I've got to make a judgment. It's the most difficult thing to do because sometimes we believe, well, if I say it this way, if I approach it this way, if I give this course, or if I give this study, or if I give this tract, or if I give this scripture, if I use this or use that, I'll be able to soften their heart. But at some point in time, we have to make a judgment that some people are just not interested in the gospel. They are hearts that are classified as hearts of the wayside. That's not just a made-up category that Jesus needed to fill out a four-point outline. Those people exist. There are people whose hearts are so hardened, it just will not penetrate. And to those, I had to be able to identify. I had to be able to make a judgment and say, okay, they're just not interested. It may be a family member. It may be a close friend. Move on. If their heart is that hardened and you've tried everything, then the only other thing that you can do is to pray that circumstances in their life will take place, that at some point what you have said and the seed that you have sown may actually find a soft spot, but move on to someone whose heart is not that hard. The last thing I want to look at real quickly. Well, it's not the last thing, but let's see all three of them. Christians judging other Christians. We have to make these judgments even among ourselves sometimes. When brethren aren't walking as they should, we have to make those judgments, and sometimes those are the most uncomfortable judgments because we know that they know, and yet they're still living as they ought not to be living. And yet we have to identify them, those who are walking disorderly. We have to acknowledge the fact that that is not acceptable. Sometimes that's an easy thing to make a judgment on, isn't it? Someone is living with his father's wife, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Well, that's pretty easy to make a judgment on, isn't it? What about those in verse 11? Paul says in verse 11, but actually, he's already said, I didn't write that letter to not associate with immoral people. I didn't mean that people of the world, he said, because then you'd have to go out of the world. But actually, I wrote not to associate with any so-called brother who is an immoral person or covetous. That's going to be a little more difficult to make a judgment on, isn't it? It's not so difficult on the immoral part, but covetous, idolater, reviler. Drunkard would be easy to identify, or easier. Swindler would probably be easier to identify. But you see, some of these, we've got to make judgment calls. That's not, that level of desire for money, that's unhealthy. And I've got to make a judgment call and say, brother, that's that your choices and your perspective on money is not right. And sometimes those won't be as clear as fornication. But Paul says you've got to make a judgment in reference to one another. You've got to make a judgment in reference to brethren causing problems. And that's, you say, well, that's easy. He's causing problems. Well, sometimes that's not as easy as what you might think. Romans chapter 16, verse 17, I urge you, brethren, keep your eye on those who cause dissensions and hindrances contrary to the teaching which you have learned and turn away from them. I've got to make a judgment call. Is what they're doing and how they're living, is that causing a dissension, causing a division, causing stress? And sometimes when we have brethren who are maybe gotten in business dealings with one another, maybe they've gotten some sort of financial cooperation with one another, and now one brother feels like they've been slighted by another brother, and so, well, I'm going to sue you over that. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, how about you find a brother in Christ that can make a judgment between you two brethren as to what should be done and not have that go before the world? Why do we have to worry about all these judgments? Here's why. Because in the end, all of our judgments, whoops, not that quick, all of our judgments are going to be judged. Every one of them. All will appear before the judgment seat of God to give an account of how they have made their judgments. Did I examine myself as I should have examined myself as I judged others? Did I join the course of empty words by not proclaiming that which is right? Did I pull back my behavior among the Gentiles so that I wouldn't be slandered as an evildoer even though I was doing good? The judgments that I make along the way of how I live my life and what I choose to say and what I choose to expose or what I choose to hold back or what I choose to go and encourage someone or how I choose to go and warn someone about their life or not warn someone about their life. All of these things, all these matters that I've made judgments about all through life, how I've responded to the judgments of others as we've seen, all those things, all those judgments that I've made will be judged by God. While we would like to be able to say, I'm going to just escape all that, we can't. Because making and receiving judgments is part of this life. It's part of living for God. In whatever culture that we might be in, God will require the same thing of you. Making and receiving judgments might be easier in other cultures and in other nations. And it might be more difficult in other cultures and nations. But the fact that God calls upon us to make judgments and the fact that we need to recognize that we'll receive judgments is going to happen wherever we may be. The one thing that you need to remember is that however we respond to those judgments and how we judge others, we will be judged. Those judgments will be judged. Appreciate your attention this morning. I know that was a lot of material to get through. I appreciate your attention this morning. I hope that as you've thought about these things, that if you've seen something in your life that is not acceptable and needs to be corrected, that there would be something that we might be able to say to you, or there's something that we might be able to encourage you to do. If there's something that we can do, would you come forward and let us know what we can do while we stand and while we sing?